I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Welcome to the New Health Club podcast. The New Health Club podcast is where the conversation around the new age of mental wellness begins. I think that psychedelics will play a big part in this, since we are talking about a new lifestyle here. So what are LSD, magic mushrooms, psilocybin, MDMA or ketamine are exactly doing for our mental health and personal progress? On the New Health Club podcast, I talk to patients who have experienced a psychedelic treatment. I talk to innovators, thought leaders, and disruptors from the emerging new world of psychedelics and mental wellness. Please enjoy the podcast. This podcast deals with drugs. Drugs are dangerous. Furthermore, the use and or trade of drugs can be punishable by law. Please keep this in mind. This podcast is not suitable for people under the age of 18. Hello and welcome to a new episode of the New Health Club podcast. Today I talk to Rosalind Watts, the clinical lead at Imperial Center for Psychedelic Research, connected through the Imperial College in London. Rosalind's TED Talk, "Can Magic Mushrooms Unlock Depression?" from 2017, was one of the first talks I've ever seen on a topic of psychedelics. Last year I met Rosalind at a Starbucks near the Imperial College, since I was writing an article for Frankfurter Allgemeine Zeitung on magic truffles. We talked for hours, and I loved Rosalind's very human and very patient-driven approach to the topic of psychedelic therapy. Watts is one of the leading scientists in the field now. She works with Robin Card-Harris, and in April this year, they just finished a clinical trial at the Imperial College in which they compared the effect of psilocybin versus the effect of antidepressants. More on that from Rosalind in the podcast. So, we talk about if COVID could be the first global ego death for all of us, which normally only happens in a psychedelic experience, that ego death. We talk about the future of psychedelic therapy and how this could become very normal, hopefully very soon. Please enjoy the podcast and Rosalind. So I'm very excited to have the famous Rosalind Watts today on my podcast. Well, you kind of are in the meantime, I would say. So I was watching your famous TED Talk last night again. And I think it was 2017, right? When you explained to a very quiet audience like what psilocybin could do. And it seems that what happened in the last couple of years is like a total fast forward situation. So, yeah, of course, it would be very interesting. How is your perception now with the kind of with the accelerating times that we live in right now? And also if it comes to psychedelics.
Yes, it's so funny to think back to that day of doing that talk and, yeah, standing out on that stage and feeling very unsure as to how people would respond to it and having this real sense that I knew that it was going to accelerate and it was going to become something that more and more people were interested in. I did know that. And I, at that point, because of it, there'd been so many years of stagnant waters because of the ban on psychedelics for so long and for so many years the research wasn't happening, I think, you know, many of us really hoped for acceleration. You know, there's so much work to do. It's got to get going again. But actually there are times now that it has started to accelerate so quickly that I feel a little bit, I can see the other side too now. I can see there are some potential risks with fast pace. And yeah, I I do wonder if sometimes the pace that we're at now might be accelerating partly due to kind of market forces and profit goals and competition, a race to the top in a way, and that those forces are very powerful. So I think that my area, which is much more about developing the therapeutic side, is getting lost in that race, because the therapeutic aspect of it is not really seen as necessary for the first stage. So I think that there are, you know, the acceleration, there is a cost to going quickly, which is that we might not do it as well as we might if we were going a bit more slowly.
You mean like with therapeutic, you mean like also that the integrational part is very important, not just like the, let's say, the medical or the trip experience. Is that what you're saying?
Yes, it's partly that. And it's also partly that I suppose I think to do, from what I've, so in the first psilocybin for depression study that was, I don't know, like 5 years ago now, six, 7 years ago, it began, and I joined partway through, and then I interviewed all the participants from that study in a qualitative study, and that was what I based the TED talk on. And I think at that time, I had this feeling, it was a small sample, it was 20 people, and 17 of them had a positive effect, and 3 of them didn't feel anything. But there were a few of those sample of the positive effects that had quite complicated responses and needed a lot of integration, extra integration. They were referred on for specialist support. And because in that small sample, it was only 1 or 2, that seemed like, oh, you know, I wonder what happened there. But now in the bigger sample that we've just done, so we've had 60 people through, or 59, I think, actually. And in all these people and all the different responses to this kind of work, we've seen so much more of the complexity emerging. So the kind of therapeutic container that I can see required to hold this level of complexity and to hold the intensity of the experience for people for whom it is such, I mean, people with depression that are coming to this as a treatment are in many ways very, very different to people that are looking to explore consciousness, and it's a very, very different kind of way of working. And as I see with this other study, the complexity getting greater and greater as you see more and more people, the therapy frame I think required to hold it really safely is going to be so involved that it might be difficult to make a profit. So I think that the models probably they're going to go ahead are going to be streamlined to a level that makes them viable commercially, which I think then brings in an element of potential vulnerability from a clinical and therapeutic point of view.
Mm-hmm. Well, I mean, but even since, like, I think when we met last year in May for that story, I think even it feels like 5 years ago, although it's just 1 year. But I mean, like, when you talk about this acceleration, I mean, even through COVID, the acceleration will be even increased. So, and also you feel that how people kind of, if they talk about themselves online, you can feel that, I mean, there's this topic of, let's call it mental wellness or mental health is even stronger because people can't suppress it anymore. Or people who are very depressed have a really hard time to even balance out what they couldn't even balance out before. So how do you think this will affect the whole, you just said it, the whole international development right now? Because a lot of, we see a lot of new studies, we see a lot of new investors. I think, when was it last week that Compass Pathway got this $80 million investment? So obviously this is, it seems to me that it's related to the time now where people see, wow, this is, there's going to be, let's say, a wave, another wave of people that might come depressed or with a PTSD symptom out of this.
Yes. Well, I really hope that psychedelics can play a really important role in what's happening now. And the timing of it in many ways is, you know, it's thinking back to 5 years ago from that talk, at that point, if something like this had happened then, I don't think the psychedelic research field had enough of a platform then really to be able to be involved in the conversation. Whereas now, because there's been so much great research happening and so much interest from so many different people and investment, that psychedelics can be part of that conversation and part of the toolbox of different ways of dealing with suffering. So I'm very pleased about that. But I think we still have to be very careful about the way we do it, because otherwise, if there is this great need for something and it pulls it forward because of that need, but it pulls it forward in a kind of diluted form, then the potential of psychedelics will be lower, I think, that we'll lose some of the potential and also will increase the risk for serious harm. So, yes, serious kind of psychological side effects, really. Like, people talk about psychedelics as not really having side effects, and of course they don't have any, apart from a headache that we see quite commonly, they don't seem to have physical side effects, unlike many other drugs. And they also are non-addictive. Physiologically, they're not habit-forming. But I think that as this plays out in a big way, I think we will see that there can be psychological side effects of this kind of work. And if people aren't held really, really well after these kind of life-changing, eye-opening, incredibly intense experiences, then, I think without that kind of holding, then there can be complications. So we need to temper the need for it and the speed at which we're trying to provide support for so many people that need it, with an eye on problems that we haven't yet really, that are just starting to emerge, that we need to keep our eye on at the same time.
What do you think is a good pace or a good speed? Are you saying that, let's say, there need to be more studies, or there has to be another conversation also that's obviously coming now from a political point of view? I mean, especially in America, because there it's obviously seems to be much worse than in Europe. And I think even like Germany has their first study fund, I think, over two million. So, I mean, it seems there's kind of a train that's starting to to leave the station. But, I mean, I'm curious what you think about it. What's your idea of the pace or the tempo?
So I think for the research, the faster that train and the bigger that train, the better. We're learning so much from the amazing research that's happening all the time. So that train, I'm very happy with it going very fast, as long as it's done carefully and, you know, taking appropriate precautions. But for studies to get through ethics committees, they have to be very well designed. So I'm not concerned about the research, as long as it's kept, you know, ethical and, the conflicts of interest are really kept an eye on. I think research, that train is good to be a high-speed train and a very big one. I think the areas of speed that I'm more concerned about are the speed of the business side of things, the for-profit, lots and lots of companies popping up, lots of psychedelic conferences all the time, all these new startups, all this psychedelic entrepreneurship, which is really, in some ways, really amazing. But, also just the idea of... the way a business works and shareholders and investment. And I think there are tensions between that model and the psychedelic care model. So I think that's one thing. Just, some kind of people talking about it in such a kind of financially oriented way about, you know, this amazing opportunity and the amount of money that can be made. And it's strange to see it that way, because I have the suspicion that when it's done adequately, it's not going to be this kind of money earner. So that there is a potential tension that when people are investing in this kind of incredible miracle cure, that they're not recognizing that for it to be a miracle cure, or not even a miracle cure, but for it to be helpful, because I don't think it really ever is a miracle cure. But when it's helpful for people, massively helpful, unbelievably helpful, life-changingly helpful, when it's done to that extent, it's done, you know, it has to be done with care. So so that's the thing, the business side of things and the potentially assumptions there that could be quite problematic further down the line. You probably saw that they will call it parlor story, was a very powerful story from the Orin Project, all about the potential risks of seeing this kind of way of working become a profit-driven approach. So that's the other thing in terms of speed. What I think the other channel, so they've got the research channel, the like business profit kind of channel, and then the other one is the therapy development channel. So we know now that psychedelic experience, that psychedelic outcomes are massively mediated by the experience in the drug session, that I don't think of it at all anymore as like a brain reset or something that you take and it resets your brain. I mean, those are some of the quotes from the participants I interviewed in the first study, and then they became kind of splashed around the media. And people sometimes describe this feeling of like, my brain was defragged, or I feel much more, you know, open and spacious. But that is one of the effects they describe. But often they will describe that effect in hindsight, after what actually at the time was possibly an incredibly difficult and challenging day for them. Like the psilocybin experience can be really very challenging and very tough. So because we're discovering more and more and more that to get those kind of good outcomes, it really is, it's about the experience someone is having, and to make sure that challenging experience, if it is challenging, comes through to a positive, beneficial therapeutic outcome, requires loads of input from therapists. So just the idea that we can give people psilocybin or the other psychedelics and that they will get better without much intervening, I don't think that's quite right or safe. So in order to see the kind of benefits that we imagine from the pilot studies on a grand scale, there is a huge amount of therapeutic skill and training that is going to be needed. And I think that is being, at the moment, that is, it's not developing to the extent that we need it for the speed that the business train is going on.
In Charité, there's this department where people can come who had a disturbing psychedelic experience, not in a guided situation, of course. So, and I think in what happens also now with this business aspect you're saying is that it seems to be merging for some people with kind of a broader sense of wellness. Yes. That sometimes, I mean, you can understand why that is so in demand now, but at the same time, I also felt, I mean, I think we talked about this, I went to Synthesis and I felt so good about this because everybody was so clear about what they were doing. Everybody knew exactly what was coming. And so, I mean, and I have to say, without that kind of system, I don't think I would have been so comfortable in this thing.
Yes.
So, and I think you're absolutely right that the therapeutical part is still kind of not addressed a lot. So I'm wondering why there's not a startup that's just creating therapies around it and just not a product, kind of, for example.
Yes, I think that's probably the thing. And also I think probably there is a kind of hope amongst startups that the therapy side of it will be minimal because the therapy is extremely expensive. And as soon as you start factoring in two therapists for a full day, the profit margin just ebbs away. So I think probably people are hoping that it is more like a drug treatment that can be given with supervision instead of therapy.
Yeah. But I mean, maybe you can talk a little bit about the latest studies at Imperial, what you're just working on or what you can talk about at the moment. Everybody's excited to know that, I'm sure.
Yes, well, we've just finished the psilocybin for depression study, which was comparing psilocybin with an antidepressant SSRI. So half the group had escitalopram, which is the best gold standard SSRI, and half the group had two high doses of psilocybin. And I wouldn't really say therapy. It was a psychological support framework. And the people that had escitalopram also had two psilocybin sessions, but with an extremely low dose, a more like kind of placebo session. And they had the full day with the music and the support from the therapist and all the follow-up meetings too. So we were kind of comparing psilocybin therapy to antidepressants plus a lot of music, meditation, support. So it wasn't quite a kind of, you know, the comparison isn't quite fair, really. Also because the psilocybin treatment that we were giving was, I would say, the very, very basic least that we would normally give. So it was like gold standard, amazing escitalopram plus lots of other things to a very, very basic, hardly enough, but just about enough model of psilocybin therapy. But despite that, we still saw, I mean, I haven't looked at the results yet. Robin will be writing up those results. My contact is much more with the participants, so I much more get a sense of the qualitative, the outcomes of people. But my sense is that we found that both conditions, you know, improved very much. Their depression for both groups was treated very effectively. My suspicion will be that the psilocybin group, their depression was treated much more quickly because SSRIs take a while to work, whereas with psilocybin, you do see this thing where somebody comes in the next day and very often they will say, you know, I feel, wow, that, you know, the shift is quite immediate. The other difference, I think, will be that, you know, psilocybin has the headache as a side effect, but apart from that, you know, it's a pretty good side effect profile, whereas antidepressants, you know, most of the people on antidepressants had real difficulties with them, you know, really bad side effects, really struggled with that.
Maybe you can say, for those who maybe don't know that, what would you say are the main side effects of SSRIs?
People have so many different ones. I'd say the main one that people describe is a feeling of like kind of detachment, a feeling a bit cut off from things. So feeling like, oh, I don't feel so bad anymore, but I also can't feel happy or good. And I feel like I'm just detached and I'm just kind of sated and numbed, a bit numbed. And then the other ones are things like having a dry mouth, having headaches often sometimes. Sometimes people have nausea. Sometimes people just describe feeling very unwell. Sometimes people have gastro stuff, like funny tummy. Changes with like urination patterns as well. And then sleep problems are very common, sexual problems as well, people losing their interest in sex. So yeah, I'd say those ones are probably the most common.
It's enough terrible side effects.
Yeah.
Okay, but sorry, coming back to the study. Yeah. So yeah.
Yes. So you know, working with these two treatments, because I had a caseload of participants that I was seeing through the antidepressants line and the psilocybin line, and of course it was double blind, so we didn't know which condition people were in. But you know, like it's kind of hard, and actually we were often surprised that in the actual psilocybin condition, like the very, very low dose placebo dose, it is still a kind of a mini, like a microdose, and actually sometimes people did have full-blown experiences from that. So I was sometimes fooled. I didn't always know which condition people were in. But seeing people through their whole trajectory in follow-ups as well, what I can see looking back is that the people through the psilocybin condition, like the high-dose psilocybin, in a way what's changed for them is their depression went, the depression has come back after a couple of months, which is what we would really expect now. You know, people do tend to see people's depression come back after a couple of months. But really, people are changing and shifting the way they see their depression. So this is the biggest shift I can see. So in the psilocybin session itself, it's all about staying with the difficult feelings, going through them, going into them and through them rather than avoiding them or resisting them, going into them, being with them, really fully feeling it. And then in the months afterwards, what seems to be happening to people, as I have continued to have kind of contact with them beyond the end of the study, is that people describe a difference in their identity. They feel more, they feel separate from their depression, like their depression was something inside them, but that they are bigger than it and that they can manage it. They can hold it. The depression pops up sometimes, but they can be with it. They don't have to feel that they're defined by it. So that's an incredible shift for people, that they describe as quite profound. And also the connected feeling, like the feeling of having more care and compassion and love for themselves, that does seem to stay even when the depression comes back. So overall, I mean, there are lots of other benefits too, but overall, I think what we'll see with the data is that both SSRIs and psilocybin are effective at bringing down the symptoms of depression, but that they work in opposite ways. So whereas SSRIs bring down the symptoms of depression, I think, by kind of numbing and minimizing responsiveness, psilocybin brings down the symptoms of depression by maximizing responsiveness and ability to feel lots of things and hold that whole repertoire of emotions and accept it more. And that not only does the psilocybin condition bring down symptoms of depression, but it also increases a whole range of other measures that I don't think SSRIs do. Increase self-compassion, increase openness, increase connectedness, all these things also improve. So I think we will see that the psilocybin treatment overall, that the profile of it is pretty impressive compared to the SSRI profile.
Well, I think, I mean, even I just did this, I mean, it was a high dose at synthesis, but even after this, yes. I felt the most significant thing is that you can say, okay, let's say I'm sad. And then you just can say, okay, I'm sad. And you just can be sad. And then maybe eventually 10 minutes later, you're not sad anymore. But it's like you can really look at an, almost like an object. You can actually see differences between various states of feelings and without really getting into them and not being able to look at them anymore. So, I mean, I mean, this comes in very simple, tiny moment. So, of course, a lot of people that actually getting in touch with us here is that a lot of people have questions about microdosing because obviously you won't get medication so far and then it's all over the place and every Vice article, it's another microdosing article every week. Yes. So, and I mean, obviously there's a study that's, I think, starting now in Maastricht, I think, with Kim Kuiper.
Yes,
which is probably very interesting, I think. But I mean, so, and again, especially now, I think there will be people, way more people than ever before, who would actually like to look into that. But at the same time, it's not really researched so far. Yeah. So what is your take on microdosing? As a scientist also, maybe.
I mean, I think that it's really hard to know until we get loads more, until the studies come back and we can really look at the data. It's really hard to know. But I guess I think it may well have a place for people. I mean, the first thing, I think people's responses to it are going to be so very different. I get lots of emails from people giving me kind of, describing their experiences with different things. And the microdosing reports I get from people are that, for some people, it helps them be more creative and more focused. But then for lots of other people, they've tried microdosing and it's completely interrupted their day because they wanted to take a microdose and go to work and be creative and be focused. And they've ended up just crying, or they've gone into difficult emotion and or they feel really kind of overly relaxed and can't focus. It's so, the way it works for people is very, very, very varied. And I think it varies for one person across different days as well. So, I don't really see it as something that, I mean, if it helps people focus more and be creative and it helps to be more productive at work, then I suppose, who am I to judge that? But I also, I really see psychedelics as tools that can really help us change the way, the kind of settings that we're on. Like if you think of like the default mode network as a kind of analogy of the life we've been living. And then what's happening now with COVID is there's this big big deactivation of the default mode network because, we're having a big ego death in a way. Things are stopping, things are pausing. And the default mode network is like the daily chatter, do this, do this, do this. Has stopped, and people have sat and been with things more. They haven't been able to do so many things. It's more about being because we're just being at home and being with ourselves. And I think that you know, we have the potential for building on this very helpful in some ways, although very painful for others, intervention from nature that is bringing about this huge pause and this huge default mode network interruption. And that to use psilocybin or any of the other psychedelics as ways of like helping us with the ego, with the ego's manifesto, the ego's agenda of doing and being more successful and getting more and all of that. Of course, we can use it that way because psychedelics are non-specific amplifiers. And that's the thing about microdosing is, you know, if it is effective, it's proven to be effective. Some people think it might just be placebo. I think it's probably is doing something, but it's amplifying something. So it's different on different days because it's amplifying different things according to certain setting. So, which is, of course, going to be more variable when you're microdosing than when you're doing a big dose. When you're doing a big dose, you're in usually a very controlled setting with a particular intention, with a particular kind of legacy of that kind of work. But with microdosing, people are just introducing it to their normal day. So the second setting is as variable as your days are. So it's going to amplify what your second setting is that day. So I think that if we choose to amplify, you know, our old concerns about doing things and being productive, then that's okay. But we could also choose instead to amplify something very different. And that would be something more in line with the kind of like the dose you did at the synthesis retreat you went on, which is actually, I'm going to stop carrying on being productive and doing this and being busy. I'm going to go into myself and I'm going to sit with the sadness. And so I think that the big doses offer opportunities when they're done in really well managed retreat settings like synthesis, offer us an opportunity to go beyond the day-to-day, beyond the ego, beyond the business, and really go down to the real feelings that have been long suppressed. So my fear about microdosing is that it allows business as usual to continue.
Interesting.
In fact, it kind of, in a way, it almost like amplifies, it can make you more effective at business as usual. And my hope for psychedelics, although sometimes I think maybe it's a naive hope, is that they could interrupt business as usual, a bit like COVID has, and bring us to our knees, you know, bring us to our knees.
Which it does.
I know.
You can totally say that.
Yeah. And bring us to our animal selves, you know, like if you think about ayahuasca, people are vomiting in a room together and people sometimes pay vast amounts of money to do that. And it's because we have a longing, I think, to come back to who we really are.
Well, I mean, this is I remember shortly before COVID, I saw this YouTube video of Gabor Maté explaining like how the disconnection from nature and other human beings basically leads to depression. And then like a couple of weeks later, it's exactly what's happening, basically. And it's interesting how you see people going, I mean, you can see it on Instagram, people going into nature that is kind of around them because they don't have to go very far right now, and taking pictures of, oh, this is a tree, look at it. It's like, yeah, okay, right? So I mean, and I have the same thing, I'm really longing for this nature experience. And I kind of, I mean, not only me, I think a lot of people according to Instagram suppressed that for a long time, kind of.
The participants from the first psilocybin for depression study, when I interviewed them 6 months after their session, their psilocybin sessions, about, you know, what had changed for them, they talked about this incredible, some of them talked about this incredible kind of awakening of a connection to nature that they hadn't felt before. So they suddenly, they understood about nature, and it was like a remembering about nature. And I think it'll be interesting to look at the analysis of qualitative reports for the participants from the study we've just done too, and see if we see the same thing. I'm sure we will. And Taylor Lyons, who's just done a study at Imperial looking at insights that healthy participants have had when taking psychedelics, and I think her nature connection data is really amazing. That lots and lots of people describe this sense of just a hunger for nature is really growing. Yeah. And my colleague Sam Gandhi, he's been doing work. He's an ecologist. And he's been doing work on psychedelics and nature connection. And he is very, very busy right now with inquiries from people who are very interested in this idea of bringing nature into the integration. So I think a combination of COVID and the hunger for nature that's going to come afterwards for so many people, and the hunger for being together in some way, plus the introduction of psychedelics, you know, the acceleration of psychedelics as treatments for mental health problems and for wellness, I think we're going to see some very exciting developments in bringing those things together. And I've kind of got in my mind like places where people can come for community building and kind of communal psychedelic integration. So people are going to do retreats in different places, and just imagine places like in other countries where it's a beautiful place in nature and where people can gather together to do. We've already started doing psychedelic integration workshops in nature. Mm-hmm. And people love them. It's, you know, it's such a lovely way of bringing people together. So I think that post-COVID, people being able to integrate psychedelic experiences together in nature will be kind of essential. So Sam Gandy, who's the colleague of mine who's doing this research with psychedelics and nature connectedness, his family are a kind of nature enthusiast family, and his mum is an expert on birds, and they keep bees, and he's very interested in lions being mushrooms. They've got all sorts of different projects going on. So where they are, which is where I am now in lockdown, we're looking at this place and just thinking, we just need to bring people here. We need people to be able to come here and sit. I mean, it's a beautiful place in nature, 1 hour outside of London. So we're thinking of ways of bringing people here so that we can learn, because in terms of thinking about the training of therapists, which is so important, my best training, my most valuable source of training, has been through the integration of participants from the first study and a psychedelic integration group that we started a couple of years ago. Because in a way, the session, I mean, I still need to learn so much about the actual acute administration phase two. There's so much to learn. But in terms of the therapeutic journey, the integration is where you learn. So if we have these places where people that are integrating psychedelic experiences can come and share with each other, and therapists are there too, the therapists learn from the participants, or the experiences, and the experiences can have access to therapists and nature. So I think it's a kind of combination that just naturally needs to happen.
Mm-hmm. And of course, you have to tell us how you got into psychedelics in the first place. Which is a while ago, I guess, like...
When I first went to university, magic mushrooms were... I went to university in a city called Birmingham, and I actually lived above a magic mushroom shop because they were legal at that time. So there was a period there was a period of about... I can't remember how many years... when magic mushrooms were legal, the Camden Market used to sell them. And so when I went to university, it wasn't really kind of, there were lots of people drinking lots of alcohol. There were lots of sports teams and kind of, you know, lots of funny old alcohol initiations going on. But my friendship group didn't really drink alcohol. And so because we lived above a magic mushroom shop, just purely by chance, that was kind of, you know, that would be our way of, you know, that would be what we would sometimes do at the weekends. And I guess it was a very interesting time, because whereas other people were out getting really drunk, we were exploring ourselves with each other. So on a Saturday night, instead of going out and kind of, you know, getting wasted, we would sit in a circle. There were like eight of us that lived in this house, eight women. And we would sit in this house and we would share about our mothers and about our lives and about our loves and our pains. And we did that the whole way through university, I'd say. I mean, not very regularly, we had a few like really seminal kind of moments where we really, at the time I was always wondering, like, is this a harmful thing? Because obviously, you know, even though they were legal, there was still that slight stigma about them. It's still seen as something quite fringe to be doing. That something inside me knew that there was, that it was really positive. But then anyway, I mean, that was years ago now. Like, that was, God, like, nearly 20 years ago. And then, so then I had a break. So after, like, discovering them there and kind of knowing that they were benign when used carefully and well, substance, like plants, because it was mushrooms, I then kind of forgot about them until, as a clinical psychologist, my best friend had depression. She went to do ayahuasca, it helped so massively. And so I was interested in ayahuasca as a treatment for depression. And then through my research into ayahuasca and what it was, I realized that DMT and psilocybin are, you know, quite similar in some ways. And so that's how I found the Imperial Research Project. So it was funny, it was like a long ago memory of like something that had been quite special to me, combining with my work and, yeah, seeing my best friend and how much she was helped by it.
So that's when you decided this is going to be a new path, also as a psychologist, right? Or like a therapist.
Yeah, I mean, I think I'd also, I never, because although those years at university when we were using mushrooms in that way, like, I could see that they were, it was a therapeutic thing to be doing. I still didn't associate magic mushrooms with therapy or psychology or that kind of thing. It was something else. But then it made such sense to me as soon as I, you know, as soon as I looked into the ayahuasca research, it just made such sense. And actually, I remember as well having a conversation with somebody whose mum, a friend of mine, whose mum had been a psychotherapist. I remember him once mentioning that she had used MDMA with a couple clients. This is years and years and years ago. Mm. It's legal. And at the time I thought, you know, it's so interesting that these things that it's kind of widely known, you know, increase these things of like empathy and love and connection, why they're not being used in therapy. Because I've been working as a clinical psychologist, working in the NHS and really, you know, respecting different types of psychotherapy, but also becoming slightly disillusioned that, yeah, they don't always work for people when they're not, you know, especially when they're done in a very brief setting, like, you know, six sessions of CBT, for example, is not effective for many people. So the idea that you could, you know, combine therapy with something that opens people up and allows them to get so much more out of it and allows them to trust you and allows them to do those painful places just seemed like, you know, it's like a light bulb moment of like, oh my goodness, of course, why would we not be doing that?
Mm. So, yeah. Okay, and so what is your, if you, let's say, could make a wish, what is your perfect outcome of the whole new, like we said in the beginning, very accelerated, very interesting, very exciting situation with psychedelics right now?
So I, at Horizons Conference of Psychedelics last October, I was watching a panel on different models for, you know, the future of psychedelics, and Rachel Aden from Synthesis did a wonderful talk. So I'm really like very, very, very supportive of what they're doing there. I think they're doing really brilliant work. There was another talk in that panel by Bennett Zellner, who is from, he's an economics professor, and he has some links with USONA, I think, and he's developing this model called the pollinator model. And the pollinator model is looking at how psilocybin, when it's manufactured by a not-for-profit format, he's developing these models for kind of disseminating psilocybin therapy based around a kind of community care model, I'd say. So, I mean, people should, you know, if people are interested in this kind of thing, it's kind of alternative to the for-profit kind of more typical kind of business approach. It's one about community, essentially. So it would be about developing centres where psilocybin therapy or, you know, other psychedelic therapies are accessible, and it's kind of run by the community for the community. And yeah, it looks like a very exciting model to me. So that would be my wish. That my real wish is that, you know, a lot of my work has been looking at connectedness, psychedelics increasing connectedness. And my real wish is that the psychedelic research community and the psychedelic business community and all the people that, you know, want and need this kind of work can join together in some way that we can create communities where psilocybin can be used in a community safe, connected setting with really good social support and integration support and networks, really good networks and structures, support structures, rather than the kind of standard medical model where it's like a treatment, and it's, you know, coming to a hospital and getting this treatment and then kind of going back to your world again. It's like creating little worlds, you know, creating connected communities where people can, join together for something. That would be my wish.
Okay. I mean, makes total sense to me, but what you say.
Yeah.
I mean, yeah.
Would you have liked that if you, after your synthesis experience?
Yeah.
Like,
actually, for example, we still have this WhatsApp group. And I mean, it's not that all the time we're writing, but I mean, every time we're writing, like exchanging, for example, the Fantastic Fungi movie or other things. Like one very nice gentleman was from England, so we had a very nice conversation after the whole thing. So, and then every time we write on that group, you have a little bit of a moment where you're like, that afternoon. So it kind of reminds you of the experience. And I mean, I think it's really if you kind of talk to people who have done this or like are in touch with people who have done this, I mean, it sounds like corny, but it is a different way of conversation. And I think this not pretending thing is a secret wish, including myself back then, for so many people that they can admit things and say, well, this is what I'm struggling with. This is what I experienced as a resolution. And I always thought I was this person, but I'm not this person. And I can just talk about myself, but I mean, I wasn't able to do this before, really. You know what I mean?
It's vulnerability, isn't it? It's a vulnerability.
Like shame has gone completely. Yes. That's the first thing.
Yes. The Brené Brown. Have you looked at any Brené Brown work?
Yeah, of course. Yeah, a lot.
Because I don't know if she's ever, like, I don't know if she's interested in psychedelics at all, but it does feel like psychedelic work is a way of opening up the kind of things she's talking about. And I think it is that kind of, I don't think vulnerability is the right word, but it's like the kind of tenderness of like, of truth, of like authenticity, of like, this is who I am. And it's so powerful when you work with people like that. And it's actually very rare.
It is.
Yeah, like it's an incredible and very noticeable thing when you're working and you can see that you can feel that kind of heart-to-heart connection because the barriers aren't there.
Yeah, I mean, that was super interesting. And I love that we had like your scientific, the moment you introduced science to the picture, people are like, okay. There's a point to it.
Yes.
So that's why it's really important.
It's a big, very important part of the conversation for sure.
Yeah. Well, thank you. That was very interesting.
Oh, thank you, Anne.
Here's a cool fact. A crocodile can't stick out its tongue. Another cool fact, you can get short-term health insurance for a month or just under a year in some states. UnitedHealthcare short-term insurance plans are designed for people who are between jobs, coming off their parents' plan, or turning a side hustle into a full-time gig. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage with access to a nationwide network of doctors and hospitals. Get more cool facts about UnitedHealthcare short-term plans at uh1.com.